you can look at multiple Hollywood films, again, mainly from the 50s and 60s, and all the way up to, I guess you could argue, sort of American Gigolo was kind of the new wave of designers getting involved with films and kind of setting trends. But people always reference those key iconic images, you know, James Dean, Marlon Brando, you know, they're always design images that people go to as iconic images. And I think that Humphrey Bogart in the trench coat is just as iconic, and therefore people always aspire to, you know, their heroes or people that they want to not look like, but kind of, you know, admire. And so I think that's probably where part of it has come from.
Nothing quite like a classic trench. British luxury brand Aquascutum has just revived the coat seen in the noir classic Casablanca. In collaboration with Humphrey Bogart's estate, we'll sit down with the company's head of menswear design soon. Also ahead,
Socrates said, "The unexamined life is not worth living, but the examined one is no bargain."
We'll head to Cannes for the first look at Woody Allen's opening night film, Café Society. Then a quick jaunt across to Vienna.
I thought in the beginning we will do mostly remote sessions, and the people will stay where they are in LA or in London. But even the directors just jump into the airplane and come here because they like to stay here.
And later in the program, Dr. Strangelove gave us a glimpse, but just how close could we come to an unintended nuclear war? We'll ask Britain's former ambassador to North Korea.
Nuclear weapons in today's age are a great deal more powerful than they were when Failsafe was made. They would do a great deal more damage over a much wider area. You'd be very unlikely to get any kind of warning, and you'd just have entire cities wiped out.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show from Midori House on Monocle 24. Hello from London, I'm Ben Ryland. We're packing our bags today in preparation for next week's show, which we'll be on location for at the Cannes Film Festival. Pedro Almodovar and Paul Verhoeven are among the renowned filmmakers with new titles screening at this year's event, but needless to say, much of the buzz has been surrounding Woody Allen's opening night film Café Society, a glistening look at Hollywood in the 1930s.
People, listen.
Are there more beautiful girls in Hollywood or New York?
Why, is that how you'll decide where you'll live?
You're very beautiful.
I'm seeing someone.
Oh.
Unrequited love kills more people in any year than tuberculosis.
Don't you want to try me?
Listen, I'm so lonely, I would have been happy just to talk, but now I'm even too tired for that.
You like jazz music?
At 2 a.m.
At any time in the morning.
Jason Solomons is the author of Woody Allen Film by Film, and he was at the first screening of Café Society in Cannes this week. Here's what he had to say.
Well, as you know, I'm slightly biased because, as Monocle listeners know, I wrote a book on Woody Allen last year and spent all year kind of talking about it and talking about it. So for me, it's a kind of, you know, closing of that chapter. I saw Woody Allen in Cannes last year with Irrational Man, and he's here again this year with Café Society. People keep saying, oh, Woody Allen films are all the same. Well, last year's Irrational Man with Emma Stone and Joaquin Phoenix was set on a campus, a philosophy campus in the East Coast. Well, this is completely different. So, you know, Yabu sucks to anyone who kind of gainsays Woody Allen on that point. This is a 1930s period piece about old Hollywood. A disillusioned Jewish kid from the Bronx, I wonder who that's based on, goes to Hollywood to kind of seek his fortune. He's called Bobby Dorfman and played by Jesse Eisenberg, who's probably the best Woody Allen proxy we've ever seen. In fact, he is Woody Allen. I mean, in real life, he writes plays on Broadway as well. So he's kind of got that Woody shtick going. He goes to Hollywood and tries to get a job in the movies, but finds it shallow and kind of an empty place, even though he's in love with Swing Time and Barbara Stanwyck movies. And then he falls in love with a charming secretary played by Kristen Stewart, and they have a sort of unrequited affair that leaves him brokenhearted, and he comes back to New York and gets a job in a nightclub there. And then we meet his family. I mean, you know, it's only an hour and 40 minutes, Café Society, and yet he packs all of this in. It's like a kind of Russian novel that sweeps through. I thought it was delicious. It's got, as we heard on the soundtrack, a little twinkling of Rodgers and Hart, who were the big kind of hit composers at the time. All of those tracks. He threw the songbook at this movie. You know, you've got A Fine Romance, Ladies of Tramp, I Didn't Know What Time It Was, all tinkling away kind of constantly throughout. I loved it. I have to say, I found it transporting and elegant and funny and wise.
Jason Solomons speaking to us from Cannes. Woody Allen's talent for dialogue has long been celebrated, which has perhaps somewhat clouded his equally superb eye for visuals. Just look at his 1979 classic Manhattan and its wonderful black and white cinematography by Gordon Willis, or the brilliant detail in the set design seen in 1978's interiors. Every so often, a film creates a kind of visual design that evokes a world all of its own. Think of John Ford's vision of the American West, or of course, Humphrey Bogart summarizing everything we've come to remember about film noir in 1942's Casablanca.
It might be a good idea for you to disappear from Casablanca for a while. There's a free French garrison over at Brazzaville. I could be induced to arrange a passage.
My letter of transit? I could use a trip. It doesn't make any difference about our bet. You still owe me 10,000 francs.
And that 10,000 francs should pay our expenses.
Our expenses? Mm-hmm. Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Those who have seen the film as many times as I have will remember Humphrey Bogart in that scene, cloaked in his classic trench on the airport's runway. And that trench has become almost as classic as the film itself. It makes sense, then, that someone should see to its revival. Well, British luxury brand Aquascutum has done just that. In collaboration with Humphrey Bogart's estate, the classic trench worn by the star in his most famous role has been recreated down to the tiniest thread. I'm joined now by Aquascutum's head of menswear design, Thomas Harvey. Thomas, thank you for being here today. Tell me, why revive a classic like Bogart's trench?
Well, obviously, Aquascutum is a brand that's got a lot of history, especially with the trench coat itself. And actually, you could argue that the brand's sort of heyday was in the 50s and 60s when it was linked with Hollywood and it was linked with a lot of actors, and in particular Humphrey Bogart wearing the brand's trench coats. And we found out through working with the archive and looking through the history of the brand that actually a lot of these films that were done in the 50s and 60s, it was actually the actors that were allowed to choose what they wore. And they specifically chose items that they felt comfortable in wearing. It's not like today where you've got huge budgets of brands arguing over sort of who can sort of control what so-and-so wears. So we actually found out that Humphrey Bogart himself actually always chose to wear the Aquascutum raincoat, which was actually, it was a style called the Kingsway back in when he had it. So, you know, it just naturally for us, it felt like something that, you know, we should celebrate. And we were talking to the Humphrey Bogart estate and, you know, they were quite keen to do something with us just purely because of Humphrey's affection for the brand back in when he used to wear it. And we just felt, you know, it was a great opportunity to celebrate not only an iconic actor, but also an iconic garment at the same time.
I think for most of us, when we think about that trench, we get that vision of Humphrey Bogart being on the runway in that final scene of Casablanca, and that the coat itself has almost become as iconic as maybe the film or even Bogart as well. From a stylistic point of view, what do you think it is about that particular design that has made it stick around for so long? It can't just be about its functionality, can it? It has to be something about it, something about the way it makes us feel, something we associate with it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that image alone has become very iconic. And you can look at multiple Hollywood films, again, mainly from the 50s and 60s and all the way up to, I guess you could argue, sort of American Gigolo was kind of the new wave of designers getting involved with films and kind of setting trends. But people always reference those key iconic images, you know, James Dean, Marlon Brando, you know, they're always design images that people go to as iconic images. And I think that Humphrey Bogart in the trench coat is just as iconic, and therefore people always aspire to, you know, their heroes or people that they want to not look like, but kind of, you know, admire. And so I think that's probably where part of it has come from.
Now, the classic trench that we are talking about, it definitely does hark back to an era that has gone by, and yet you're launching it in what is 2016. Tell me how you think those two things will come together.
Well, we've seen a lot of people kind of go back to kind of the basics of dressing, let's say. So like I said, they want trench coats that actually fit them. They work over suits. They protect you from the rain. You know, they want the collar to actually stand up and do something instead of just being there on the garment. So we've tried to remain as true as possible to the detailing that we would have had on the Kingsway coat. We've obviously trimmed it down slightly, and it's not as it's got as much volume as, let's say, it used to. But, you know, I think what we're really trying to do is say to people, you know, trench coats and raincoats, they're there for you to decide how you want to wear them. Of course, yes, the iconic way to wear it is over a suit, and you kind of can almost look very sophisticated with possibly a Savile Row suit and a shirt and tie and, you know, this beautiful raincoat over the top of it. Or a younger guy I saw in a Japanese fashion magazine, they did something with it where they put a young guy in a t-shirt, a pair of jeans and a boot and a rucksack, and he looked really, really cool. And, you know, it was almost like you go back to that idea of when you're a kid and you sort of go through your father's closet and steal his nice clothes because you want to wear them, and you put your own twist on it. And I think that's really kind of what it's going to come down to. It's how people want to wear it themselves, and hopefully there'll be a new generation of people that want to kind of wear that item in a different way. But you're also going to get the guys that grew up with Humphrey Bogart and want to be him again.
From Casablanca to Vienna now, which is still quite rightly the uncontested global centre of classical music. And it may soon become a hub for film music production too, following the revival of its hallowed Rosenhügel film studios. Already, the score for the upcoming Ron Howard film Inferno was recorded there, and that's even before its official opening. Monocle's Alexei Korolev went along to take it in and scope it out.
Yeah, that's the big hall of the synchron stage, 540 square meters, up to 15 meters high, and built for a maximum of 130 musicians who can perform inside. Room was designed and built for music recording, especially film music recording in the 40s.
This is the legendary Rosenhügel Film Studios, once one of the biggest centers for film score production in Europe. And the man I'm talking to is Herbert Tuchmann, its owner and CEO.
We are the first private owners of this building. Before, it was more or less in state property.
I'm in luck. Today is a recording day, and the cacophony you can hear in the background is the sound of musicians tuning their instruments as they prepare to play the soundtrack to the upcoming Netflix series, The Crown. Originally opened in 1923, this was the cradle of the Wiener film, the Austrian film genre prominent between the 1920s and 50s that mixed comedy and drama, typically in a historical setting.
Is this like the everyday busy?
The next week, the whole week will be recording started here, yeah. And at the moment, the people have the lunch break and prepare for the afternoon session for the Crown recordings for the new Netflix series about the Queen and her family.
So basically, of this facility, it's a room construction, very massive one.
Now called Synchron Stage Vienna, the facility was bought out by Tuchmandl in 2013, after decades of neglect. By then, he had already achieved success with something called the Vienna Symphonic Library, one of the world's leading producers of orchestral music samples and software. Although not fully operational yet, the studios is, as we heard, already heavily in use. The grand opening is planned for July.
Now, yeah, the grand opening is important for all the people here in Vienna who helped us to get access to the building. Of course, it's a kind of a step-by-step finalizing here, and in July everything should be completed. Also our second control room especially. And of course we will invite some international guests also here. Konrad Pope, who conducted our first recording session here in October last year. Maybe Dave Grusin, so we will show if he's available at that time. In the meantime, everybody realizes this will become a main factor here in Vienna. I thought in the beginning we will do mostly remote sessions, and the people will stay where they are, in LA or in London. But even the directors just jump into the airplane and come here because they like to stay here. So Vienna is a very nice city, where you can also spend a few days off, of course. So it's a nice place to stay, simply, beside the work you have to do here, of course.
Turns out that this is one of the best acoustics in the world, this stage by itself. And very amazing the way they built this thing. It's a building within a building.
This is Dmitry Levich, a world-renowned violinist who performed on more than 200 films, including Titanic and Avatar, and is now the concertmaster at Synchron Stage Vienna.
And so it's very exciting to play in there. And of course, a lot of movies nowadays, since the business is global, It's not anymore centered just in Southern California. It's all over the world, not just the filmmaking, but also the post-productions. So why not also bring some stuff to Vienna? And so far already, as it shows, we already have quite a few people coming here, you know, well-known Hollywood composers. You know, today we're working here with Rupert Gregson Williams. We have had already Hans Zimmer also, actually not him in person, but we did work on the movie Inferno. We did some stuff, and we have quite a few projects lined up.
There's a working place with a Lutner concert grant and an audio workstation.
I'm very happy about the decision, yeah.
That's Herbert Tuchmandl again, the CEO. The decision he's talking about is, of course, his purchase of this facility back in 2013 from the state broadcaster ORF. It had just been listed and was in a terrible state of repair.
So it was, of course, a heavy financial decision also. So the building was not that expensive, but the investment into this house was very expensive. Everything had to be renewed, especially all the technical stuff was not existing anymore, but also heating, cooling, air conditions have to be done completely new. And this was the most expensive part, not because of the size of this house. As it's always very, very cool feeling to sit in the control room or in the stage when the musicians are here and start playing a new project, new music. So we had also classical recordings already done here. The Vienna Chamber Orchestra recorded all Beethoven piano concertos. We had the Vienna Klavier piano trio here who performed for us some piano trio literature just to verify how chamber music works in the big hall. And it's incredibly good feeling not just to listen to the music which is played here.
The Rosenhügel Film Studios missed out on quite a lot of blockbuster action during its years of oblivion, but it looks set to return to center stage. The Wiener Filmer, Viennese Films, may be a thing of the past, but Vienna-produced films may just be the future. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you, Alexei. Most of us will know the story behind Stanley Kubrick's film Dr. Strangelove, but it was actually another film from the same year that realistically portrayed what might happen in the case of an accidental nuclear strike. We'll talk to Britain's former ambassador to North Korea next.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page, large-format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
Five, four, three, two, one.
In the mid-1960s, fears over an unintended nuclear annihilation were captured in bleak shades of humour with Stanley Kubrick's classic Dr. Strangelove. But there was actually another film released in 1964 with an almost identical plot that you've probably never heard of. That's because Kubrick made sure of it. Failsafe is the work of director Sidney Lumet, probably best known for his brilliant 1976 satire on the world of television news network. Based on the book by Eugene Burdick and Harvey Wheeler, both political scientists, it puts a realistic take on what might happen should the US unintentionally launch a nuclear strike. In this case, the target is Moscow.
And what's the difference between 60 million dead and 100 million?
40 million.
Some difference.
Are you prepared to say the saving of 40 million lives is of no importance?
You miss the point, Professor. The saving of those 60 million lives is what's important.
Face facts, Mr. Foster. We're talking about war. I say every war, including thermonuclear war, must have a winner and a loser. Which would you rather be?
In a nuclear war, everyone loses.
More than 50 years later, the world may seem like a very different place. Yet the threat of an increasingly aggressive Russia still lingers, and rumblings from North Korea and Iran are never far from the news headlines. So is the world really any safer from an unintended nuclear crisis? And could the events of Failsafe really happen? Well, we asked Britain's former ambassador to North Korea, John Everard.
It's not completely impossible, but the chances of it happening are vanishingly small. The failsafes built in, both when the film was made and even more so now to any nuclear strike, are very, very careful. Remember that in 64, when Failsafe was made, the United States Air Force refused to cooperate with the filmmakers because they're so horrified at the idea that their failsafes might actually break down. They were quite convinced this wasn't possible and didn't want to play along with the producers. Below the nuclear level, of course, we have had instance of that happening. Remember the accidental NATO bomb of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade not so many years ago. Somebody simply got the wrong targeting coordinates. So that kind of mistake is possible. But as I say, I think at the nuclear level, you'd have to be very, very, very unlucky. Way back in 64, the United States Air Force was at pains to say that the entire plot was wrong. It, you know, things just would not happen that way. Fast forwarding today, I think that applies even more so. I mean, none of the nuclear powers, of course, have put into the public domain what rescinding systems they might have. But I think we can be pretty sure that they do exist, that if you had time to intercept one of your own missiles launched in error, if that ever happened, to before it reached its target, that you would have the means to destroy it in midair. Of course, these days, the response times would have to be very much faster. Back in the days of Failsafe, you had all the time it took for an aircraft to fly from, I think it was actually supposed to be hovering somewhere over Europe, wasn't it, towards Moscow. Now you have to try and catch up with a missile. You might have a few minutes. You might well have to make decisions in seconds, so the time frame is very much compressed. If we assume that the strike hits a pre-planned target, which would either be a significant military asset or, as in Failsafe, a city, then history goes round a sharp corner, doesn't it? The different countries have different reasons for wishing to acquire nuclear weapons. The two examples you've just mentioned, though, Iran and North Korea, I think it's quite clear that they believe that the possession of nuclear weapons, certainly in the case of North Korea, gives them an insurance policy against attack, particularly massive conventional attack, by countries they perceive as their enemies. Is there a chance of their launching a nuclear strike in error? I think that's unlikely. I think that the much greater risk, and the one that we grapple with all the time, is that they launch a nuclear strike deliberately, that they miscalculate, that they think they can get away with it or whatever. That applies particularly in the case of North Korea, a country that has repeatedly miscalculated in diplomacy and which, although it has just announced again that it would not launch a nuclear first strike, nobody entirely trusts not to do just that. We've had some very unpleasant but fortunately localized wars over the last 30 or 40 years, but the world in general has remained a safe and a broadly conflict-free place. We can't count on that continuing. There's a great deal in the world right now that could go seriously wrong. And for the first time in a long time, planets are actively having to assess the real risk of a nuclear war. Nuclear weapons in today's age are a great deal more powerful than they were when Failsafe was made. They would do a great deal more damage over a much wider area. They could be delivered at much greater speed. The attack would be sudden. You'd be very unlikely to get any kind of warning, and you'd just have entire cities wiped out. It would be unspeakably horrible. Way back during the Cold War, the United Kingdom elaborated quite careful plans for what would happen if we here were ever subjected to nuclear strikes. They're still around. There is what would have been the control centre for Southeast England in the village of Kelvedon Hatch, just to the northwest of London. The bunker's still there, and you can sort of see the videos that would have been put out. Essentially, they assume that very, very large numbers of people are killed instantly, even large numbers are incapacitated and can't work and have to be shot, and that, you know, any kind of livestock that can't be eaten is simply slaughtered on the spot because it becomes a carrier of all kinds of disease and nuclear waste, and that instant military rule is imposed. The government, even then, never actually revealed just how many people they thought would be killed in a nuclear strike, but it's quite clear from the preparations they made that it must have been over 50% of the population.
Breaking news out of North Korea once again, where Pyongyang is now threatening a nuclear strike.
I think you would need to see the reining in of rogue states who are quite clearly moving towards a significant nuclear capability. North Korea is the first one that comes to mind. We appear to be making quite a lot of progress in the case of Iran. Let's just hope that things stay that way. And there are a few others around the world. I mean, there's a list of states that have effectively nuclear capability, but who have never actually declared it. And we would need to see a return to the structures in international diplomacy of the 1960s and 70s, where problems were ironed out in multilateral fora in large groups, rather than in shouting and screaming matches bilaterally, if at all. Frankly, I don't think we'll see any of those things.
John Everard, Britain's former ambassador to North Korea. While Failsafe excels in its real-time take on the day everything went wrong in Washington, the real-life consequences of nuclear warfare are perhaps best summed up by the inventor of the bomb itself, J. Robert Oppenheimer. Here he is recalling the first detonation.
We knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Failsafe is screening now for Mubi subscribers here in the United Kingdom, and you can even compare it with the better-known Stanley Kubrick classic Dr. Strangelove, which is also now showing. The Cinema Show is presented in association with Mubi, the curated movie site of cult classic and award-winning cinema. And if you're interested in a whole month of movies for free, well, here's a suggestion for you. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. Now, we'll be coming to you from the Cannes Film Festival for next week's program. David Jenkins is the editor of Little White Lies magazine. He's been at the big event since day one, and he joins me now on the line. David, hello. Give us a sense, first up, of what the atmosphere is like over there.
Yeah, the weather's been quite nice, which always helps. No typhoons or monsoons yet. There has been kind of a heightened sense of security here, I think, what with the kind of Paris terror attacks earlier in the year. There's more security guards on doors and more bag checks and metal detectors. So, yeah, there's more of a sort of heightened alert, high tension here, I guess.
So perhaps then tell us a little bit about how the feeling is and how the mood is. Does it still feel as though you are at the pinnacle of all film festivals?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think the strange thing about Cannes is that, you know, it's this constant crashing waves of news stories that sort of roll in, and, you know, you have the opening film with Woody Allen, and you have a press conference, and there is, you know, some amount of controversy around that, and people talking about the quality of the film, and then, you know, just as that kind of reaches its own sort of zenith, something else comes along, another film is shown, the conversation changes again, and it's almost like a kind of real-life Twitter feed where you're just being bombarded with information and opinions, but it's more physical, I guess, and it's quite pleasant.
And that's it for today. Be sure to catch next week's show, where we'll be on location at the Cannes Film Festival. Thanks to our editor Nina Norek and researcher Yolien Goffin. Catch up on past episodes of this show over at our website, monocle.com. And remember to subscribe to the podcast too. This has been The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.